You're on the ag policy too.
Good morning, everyone. Calling this meeting to order, and just we'll start with a couple of announcements, which we will do in the end, too. I think other people will be like me and get stuck behind a red light that was frozen red this morning. So I suspect there are other issues for people as they come in this morning. We didn't have a lot of time for questions at the end of our last session. The agencies have volunteered to answer any questions you might have. If you write them down, and you can send them to us, any one of us, or directly to the agencies, and we will get them out to all members and also post them on our website so folks can hear. If we run into problems today in the same way, we will have the same procedure. This will not be the last hearing on waters in particular. We will do another one. As soon as we have two more hearings on science and what it is telling us, then we'll go straight into budget hearings, and we will have them scheduled so we have everything here from all of the agencies and all of our accounts by the February forecast. So that may mean some Tuesday night hearings. I don't know yet, but we are doing that kind of scheduling. So we will. Yes, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how long do you anticipate the walkthrough from PCA and DNR each in number of hours, or what are you anticipating there?
That's what we're working on right now, and as soon as we get that schedule, we'll let you know. We are not putting constraints on their time. We'll just say, you tell us how much time you would like. And we can't tell yet because we haven't seen that budget.
Okay, and so do you anticipate, Madam Chair, do you anticipate 3-4 meetings for each of those agencies?
As long as it takes, Representative McNamara, and we haven't seen the budgets, but as soon as they come in and we will do that scheduling, we will put it out for folks, and if they want more time, we will make sure we schedule it. Representative McNamara.
And then, Madam Chair, did I hear you that you want to have them done by the end of February?
That would be a goal, yes.
Thank you.
For the overviews, just the overviews of the budget. We have a lot of accounts, so that is a stretch, but I think to keep on time, that would be a good idea. So that's how we're going to do it. With that, welcome to a list of speakers this morning, organized by our agencies, and I appreciate their work on it. They have been, and DNR in particular, has pulled this together, and we appreciate their doing that. But we'll start with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Don Stardock and Bruce Montgomery. And would you introduce yourselves for the record? Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm with the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to present on this important topic. This is the second of two presentations on groundwater. First presentation was last Thursday, which focused primarily on water quantity. This presentation will focus primarily on water quality. Groundwater sustainability, which is defined in statute, includes consideration for both water quality and quantity, and both must be adequate to support drinking water development and ecosystems. I'm going to present a little bit of a general introduction. I'm going to present a general introduction to groundwater quality issues and cover some concepts that apply to all of today's presentation. Minnesota groundwater is managed through a multi-agency approach. Each agency has certain responsibilities related to areas in which they have expertise, in which they have related programs for permitting, pollution prevention, or regulation. The agencies coordinate activities through an interagency groundwater team, and the relationships and communications between agencies are excellent. If Through this team, we ensure that we are sharing resources and coordinate activities to prevent duplication of effort. All of the people presenting today on the are on the Interagency Groundwater Team. So why are we concerned about groundwater quality? There are a variety of contaminants, both natural contaminants and human-induced contaminants, that can pose a significant risk to water supplies or may have an impact on ecosystems. These include contaminants like nitrates, arsenic, bacteria, viruses, pesticides. A recent example is of something new was perchlorinated compounds, solvents, chloride, and pharmaceuticals, and there are others. Some of these contaminants, such as nitrates, pesticides, chlorides, or arsenic, may be widely present in groundwater, especially in shallow aquifers which are vulnerable to groundwater contamination. Other contaminants, such as pesticides, solvents, perchlorinated compounds, can pose risk to human health and the environment at extremely low concentrations, the part per billion or even the part per trillion level. Some of these contaminants do not have a health standard, and some new contaminants do not even have a reliable laboratory method which can detect them at low concentrations. From a scientific perspective, it can be very challenging to monitor groundwater for many of these compounds. Evaluating groundwater quality requires some form of monitoring. The purpose for groundwater monitoring is to gather information over time to inform decision-making to address a specific issue or concern. It's important to understand that groundwater monitoring programs must be designed to address a specific information need. Groundwater is generally monitored through sampling wells. However, all wells are not the same. In some cases, drinking water wells may be usable for monitoring, but in many cases, to properly understand the hydrogeology, groundwater levels and flow patterns, contaminant concentrations, and changing concentration trends over time, it's necessary to install a custom-designed monitoring well network. Laboratory analytical methods used for many contaminants can be very expensive and may require completely different sampling procedures and analytical instruments. When laboratory detection limits are at the part per billion or part per trillion level, it's extremely easy to contaminate a sample, and there's absolutely no room for error. If monitoring is done incorrectly, the results may be misleading or even unusable. In some cases, if monitoring is conducted incorrectly, it could falsely suggest that groundwater quality is improving or getting worse, or that groundwater is safe or unsafe to drink. For these reasons, groundwater monitoring is a highly specialized field of science, and agencies are very careful about their approach to monitoring. There's also some key concepts for groundwater that are important to understand anytime that you have discussions on groundwater. First, remember that groundwater and surface water are two parts of a single flow system. Water from the land surface infiltrates and recharges groundwater. Similarly, groundwater discharges into surface water. For many streams and rivers, groundwater is the primary source of their flow over much of the year. Although for practical reasons, we may have to focus on groundwater or surface water independently in order to understand and manage them, they are parts of a single hydrologic system, and they should be viewed that way. It's also important to understand that groundwater quality and quantity are closely linked. Increased pumping of a well may change groundwater flow patterns and draw contaminated water into a well. Conversely, there may be adequate quantities of groundwater available to support a municipal well or some other activity. But if the water quality is inadequate, the water may be unusable or may require expensive treatment. A sustainable water supply must provide for adequate quantities of clean water. Also be aware that in many aquifers, although not all of them, groundwater can move very slowly. In many aquifers, travel times are on the order of years, and in deeper aquifers, much longer than that. If you recall from the presentation last Thursday, water less than 50 years old was considered young. This means there can be a long lag time between actions at the land surface and their impact on water quality. For this reason, it's extremely important to prevent contamination of groundwater in the first place. Investing resources to prevent contamination may be much wiser and far more cost-effective than actions to clean up an aquifer that is already degraded. So that ends my initial presentation. I'm now going to turn it over to Bruce Montgomery, who's going to talk about nitrates and groundwater.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Bruce Montgomery. I'm the section manager, what's called the fertilizer non-point section at the Department of Agriculture. And I sincerely hope by the end of the session today, you're going to hear a lot and have a good understanding of what some of the challenges are. And hopefully this will be very helpful for you in the decision-making process in the future. Just to be very clear, I'm going to be talking specifically on nitrates. This is a significant problem in groundwater systems. You're going to hear a lot of discussion about various contaminants today, and nitrate, or NO3-N, is the typical way that we express this particular contaminant. Why the concerns about this? First of all, there is some very well-documented health issues associated with nitrates in groundwater, particularly with infants. It's odorless, colorless. The only way you're going to know if it's in your drinking water supply is by testing for it. Dan talked a little bit about water age, and if this once gets into groundwater, it's quite persistent. Very few of our aquifers have the inherent chemical capability of actually cleaning themselves up. So once it gets in the groundwater, it's typically there for a very, very long period of time. And one of the big challenges we have is that nitrogen is an essential plant nutrient. We absolutely have to have it. There's no substitutes for it, unlike pesticides. We absolutely have to have this to maintain crop yields. So there's a number of issues here, but primarily where we do find nitrate contamination problems are in our agricultural system. So I think it's very fitting that the Department of Ag is representing this discussion. And once it gets into the groundwater systems and nitrogen loading, it can be a significant problem. I want to emphasize where we traditionally see these problems are in very localized regions. Typically they're where we either have very coarse textured soils and shallow depth of groundwater, or in our karst region. This happens to be a graphic showing the nitrate concentration rises at the city of Park Rapids. We'll talk a little bit more about this in just a couple of minutes. But as you can see, the nitrate levels in the drinking water standard, by the way, is 10 parts per million. In this particular example, you can see over the last 20 years, those concentrations have gone up extremely fast. One of the big challenges we have is nitrogen is extremely elusive. I always think of and describe it to growers as it's kind of the Houdini of the plant world. What this cartoon shows is the nitrogen cycle, and this is a very simple graphic of all the various ways nitrogen in different forms can take place. The primary one is the one that we're showing on the bottom, where nitrate, because of its solubility, can leach to the soil profile through the substrata and into groundwater systems. So it's a very mobile element that we have to deal with. And to kind of get an understanding of some of the stressors on our groundwater systems, we have to talk about a couple of things, and cropping systems is one of them. What's grown on the land has a profound impact on what we're going to see in our groundwater systems. And the other thing I really want to emphasize is these cropping systems that we put in place are not created equal. We heard a little bit from the university last week about the value of perennial cropping systems or cover crops, and one of the things we want to share with you is a little bit of information about the value of some of these cropping systems, particularly the perennials, alfalfa, clover, also CRP. These are all very conservative systems. They are extraordinarily good at scavenging nitrogen. We typically do not see appreciable leaching losses coming out of these systems. Also vegetative pasture, and there's a variety of crops that really have low impacts on groundwater systems. Now what's happened over the last 90 years, and this is information from our Minnesota Ag Stats, we got to keep track of our acres and how they're used of the approximately 20 million acres of farmland that we have. We can see over the last 90 years that we've lost a lot of these perennial cropping systems. Alfalfa and clover, for example, have dropped appreciably. A lot of this is linked to our livestock industry and the fact that we've had a lot of consolidation, a lot of loss, particularly in the dairy industry. And this can have profound impacts, particularly in areas like the Southeast Karst, where that plays a very important role. The flip side to these changes is the fact that we now bring in other cropping systems such as soybeans. And even though it's probably one of the oldest crops known to mankind, it didn't really take off in the United States and in Minnesota until around World War II. And as you can see now, we typically grow about 7 to 8 million acres of soybean systems. And the reason that's important is that these all have very profound impacts on groundwater and groundwater recharge. The other thing that's happened is we've lost a lot of acres of small grains. What I'm talking about here is barley, wheat, and rye, durum. At one time, Minnesota grew an enormous amount of these small grains. And these have very fibrous systems, the fact that they're usually drilled, solid seeded, a pretty conservative system in terms of groundwater contributions. Again, the flip side, to replace a lot of that, we've seen an enormous increase in our corn acres. We are now at about 8 million acres, and that will stay probably pretty strong for the years to come. And one of the problems that we have with some of these cropping systems, like corn, silage corn, also potatoes and edible beans are thrown in. These are some of the crops that, as an agronomist, we have very difficult challenges ahead of us on how we manage inputs and try to minimize the amount of losses that are coming out of these systems. And lastly, the other flip side to this, not only the kind of the historic changes in our cropping systems, but we also need to consider the fact that we've become very dependent on commercial fertilizers. This is a relatively new phenomena. It wasn't until about the mid-60s that we really started to understand how to process and manufacture nitrogen cost effectively. And between the late 60s and about 1980, we saw a very dramatic increase in our commercial fertilizer sales. This graphic shows the trends in both the United States and Minnesota. The axes are different, with Minnesota being on the left, but the trends are very much the same. So these are some of the challenges ahead, and one of the things I do want to point out, the fact that growers, our Minnesota farmers, our ag professionals and dealers continue to strive in trying to increase efficiency out of these nutrient inputs, and nitrogen is no different. What this graphic shows is the amount of production that we get out of every pound of commercial fertilizer put into the system. So in this particular case, we're talking about 1.4 bushels produced for every pound of nitrogen. And you can see that these increases have gone up dramatically. There's a number of reasons for that, but the good news is that growers are getting more and more efficient with time. So let's talk just a little bit about where we're at in terms of water quality, again, regarding nitrates. And the biggest and most historic data set that we have is called our County Well Index. The Department of Health administers this program. It's a very large database, a lot of the records and the required testing that goes into the County Well Index began in the mid-70s when the well codes were changed. And there's about 500,000 wells in this data set. And so it's a very large one. Now, the problem with it and using it to try to characterize nitrate problems is it's a point-in-time analysis. So when the well is drilled, the well driller is required to take a sample for nitrate and bacteria. The well logs are submitted, and the Department of Health keeps track of where those wells are located. So it really doesn't give us a reflection on changes over time. But what this does tell us from these observations, and what this graphic shows, is only wells over 3 parts per million. To simplify it, what it does show is where we tend to see problems. In the central sand plains is one of our biggest challenges right now. Again, coarse textured soils, number of specialty crops, irrigation, there's a lot of factors that go in there. Dakota and Washington County are also quite problematic. But what the County Well Index does not show us in this particular example is some of the problems that we've seen historically in areas like southeast Minnesota. And part of the problem is the well index started in the mid-70s. There's a lot of wells that are still being used that were put in before those well codes went into play. The agencies recognize that we needed some better tools to help the public understand where we're going with nitrates and those trends. I'm just going to say a couple of words about a new type of a monitoring network that's been developed just in the last 5 to 6 years, and we call them voluntary homeowner networks. These networks are designed to be low cost. They're statistically based, so there's a grid overlaid. We have two of these in place right now, one in the Central Sands and one in the Karst. Again, these are predetermined monitoring networks. They're not random, so we actively seek a willing participant in each one of the nodes shown on these maps. And this is truly a multi-agency effort. Department of Health, PCA, MDA, and our local soil and water districts and Environmental Health Services make these things happen. And again, the concept here is trying to maintain very low cost and our ability to continue with trend analysis. I just want to acknowledge that Minnesota families are the cornerstone to this type of an approach. The homeowners take the samples for us. What we find is that many, many homeowners are very happy to participate with us. We get about a 70% success rate when they're contacted, and they are really the cornerstone of these type of programs. Again, low cost, something that we could sustain for many, many years is our ultimate goal with these networks. Just a couple of words on the Central Sands Network. This includes 14 counties and just the areas where we have superficial sandy soils. As you can see, the network here includes about 1,600 farm families, or Minnesota rural families, by the way, across this network. The data suggests that about 5% exceed the standard. And the value of this type of information is twofold. A snapshot in time, so we have a good understanding of where we're currently at. But what we've done here now is selected about a third of these homeowners to participate in a long-term network with us. So we'll truly have some good information for generations to come. The Southeast is similar. This was started with the help of PCA's 319 program, and the Southeast Joint Powers Board started this network. A little bit more complicated because of the multi-aquifers that we find in the Karst area. What we do have is 6 samplings so far. What we're seeing down in the Karst is between 8 and 12% of the wells exceed the drinking water standard. I think the real value here is helping us understand where we're going with this for the long haul. And I want to acknowledge the Department of Health for taking a lot of the leadership in this particular network. One last thing about private wells, and then I'm going to wrap things up very quickly, but our most recent analysis suggests, and the way this map is generated, is looking at the most sensitive townships based on prop layers and groundwater sensitivity. And this data suggests that we have somewhere between 200 to 300 townships that we have some concerns about, our potential risks. So one of our big challenges coming up now is how are we going to help local townships and counties deal with the testing, accelerated testing, and really try to get a good understanding of where these private wells are currently at. And just summarizing, closing things up, I do want to say a couple of things about public water suppliers. Department of Health and Randy Ellenbo will walk us through that discussion. But in terms of nitrates in private drinking or public drinking water supplies, what we're seeing is about less than 1% of those water supplies exceed the drinking water standards. What this cartoon or graphic shows is just the wells, again, that are above 3 parts per million. Again, Central Sands and the Southeast are our biggest challenges. But the ones that the Department of Ag is very, very interested in, and we have some long history with some of these community water supplies. The ones with the red halos are agricultural communities, and by that we're defining the wellhead areas that are 30% or more in cropland acres, and also are above 3 parts per million. And we roughly have about 20 to 25 ag communities that the Department of Ag, Department of Health, and our local partners are working with very actively on trying to address this issue. Talked a little bit about Park Rapids when I began this talk. We're seeing a small number of communities that have similar trends, St. Peter, Hastings, Verndale, Clear Lake. There's a small handful of them that are showing some pretty significant increases in those concentrations. What's at stake here, I think, is really critical. And these types of installations that need to be put in if water treatment is the only option left is that we're looking at somewhere between $2 to $3 million per facility. Hastings just put one in about 4 or 5 years ago. St. Peter, likewise. Again, a pretty significant upfront cost, and the maintenance cost for these systems is also staggering. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes things going on that public water suppliers have to deal with, putting in new wells, blending water down. Those are very typical techniques that these public water suppliers have to go through. There's some society costs associated with all of those types of things, even though they may not be headline news. Our best estimates, working with the University of Minnesota and the public water suppliers, our best estimates are that consumers are paying somewhere between 2 to 6 times more for water because of nitrates than in areas that that is not an issue. So this is a very significant problem, again, on a very localized region. In closing, we've learned an awful lot about how to deal with some of these public water suppliers that are dealing with agricultural issues. Department of Health and Department of Ag have developed a series of case studies and tools to help public water suppliers. If you're interested in that information, there's a website on the bottom that can get you those materials. So with that, I'm going to close, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Nice job. We will hear from all of the presenters, and then we will have a good time for questions on that.
Madam Chair and members, our next speaker is Dr. Joseph Zachman. He's a senior research scientist with the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division at the Department of Ag, and he's going to discuss pesticides in Minnesota ground.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joseph Zachman. I'm a research scientist at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'll be giving you a very brief overview of why the department monitors for pesticides in groundwater and some of our results. Pesticides are a very broad class of chemicals, each with very unique properties, properties that are designed to control, for example, insect pests, weeds, and diseases. But some of those same properties may pose a risk to human health and the environment. Some pesticides leach to groundwater, and people have real concerns about their exposure risks. Are there pesticides in my drinking water? How high are the concentrations? And even if the concentrations are very low, what about unknown risks like exposure to pesticides in mixtures, endocrine disruption, or other concerns? So we monitor groundwater to gauge the potential risks from the use of pesticides. Our monitoring networks are designed primarily for agricultural pesticides. The photograph shows a typical placement of monitoring wells near the edge of an operating farm field in the vulnerable central sand plains of central Minnesota. In the sensitive karst bedrock areas of southeastern Minnesota, we monitor groundwater through springs. Because of our program's agricultural focus, our monitoring design differs from the designs used by programs that track industrial contamination, aquifer sustainability, or public water supplies. This map shows our current groundwater monitoring locations distributed among 10 different pesticide monitoring regions, shown in the small colored map further to the right. The pesticide monitoring regions were developed jointly with the University of Minnesota and other state agencies and are characterized by unique factors like climate, cropping practices, soils, and groundwater vulnerability. In 2011, the department analyzed 276 groundwater samples collected from 171 wells or sites. We recently used some Clean Water Fund dollars to purchase state-of-the-art laboratory equipment that can find pesticides at lower concentrations than ever before, and also allowed us to increase the number of pesticides we analyzed for and the number of samples we analyzed. Each sample is analyzed for 110 different pesticides or degradates. That amounts to about 30,000 analyses annually that we conduct. And as new pesticides are registered, they are reviewed for risk and may be added to the analytical list. 40 pesticides or degradates are detected. Most of those are found in fewer than 4% of samples. One or more of five corn herbicides can be found frequently in vulnerable aquifers, and the MDA has developed best management practices for those herbicides. No pesticide concentrations are exceeding the Department of Health drinking water levels of concern. Here are some detailed results of the corn herbicide metolachlor and its derivatives. These are among the most frequently detected compounds in the Central Sands groundwater. The upper graph shows that median concentrations have fluctuated over the last decade and are several hundred times lower than the Department of Health's known levels of concern for drinking water. The lower graph shows detection frequency. And for metolachlor, the parent compound, it's the bottom line that shows red on the screen, the lowest line in the graph. That shows the detection frequency for metolachlor, and detections have been declining since 2000. However, the detection of the degradates, the upper blue and green lines, appears to be steady or gradually rising at about 40 to 70% of the samples. The metolachlor degradates appear to persist in the groundwater environment of the Central Sands, and that persistence is a concern to the Department of Agriculture. This graph shows median concentrations of atrazine and its toxicologically significant degradates in the Central Sand Plains over the last dozen years. Although the compounds are frequently detected, concentrations have decreased significantly from a quarter of a part per billion in 2004 to very low values in the last 4 to 5 years, values so low that they are near the limits of our ability to detect them with our laboratory equipment. Using the same types of graphs, here's data for atrazine and its degradates in three DNR fish hatchery springs in southeast Minnesota. Median concentrations over the last dozen years appear to be in general decline. The graph below shows detection frequencies for these compounds are high in all of the southeast springs that we monitor, and for one of the degradates is nearly 100%. The trends here are different from those in the Central Sand Plains because in southeast Minnesota, both climate and geology contribute to a very different year-to-year changes in pesticide impacts. Spring rainfall, intense storms, and drought can produce radically different annual results. There are a number of uncertainties we face in our monitoring program that translate into potential groundwater risks. New pesticide-resistant crop introductions and weed or insect resistance to current pesticides can lead to new or increased pesticide use. New invasive species control sometimes requires new pesticide use. And the effect of climate change on pests and on weather patterns can lead to new pesticide uses and greater runoff or leaching. All pesticide monitoring data is reviewed annually by a multi-stakeholder committee comprised of environmental groups, state agencies, farmers, and others. Data is submitted to the Department of Health, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Environmental Protection Agency for evaluation. And finally, all data is published in reports and stored in the Pollution Control Agency's Water Quality Database. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address you on these important topics. There is also a one-page summary of key MDA program information on pesticide groundwater monitoring provided to community members, and my contact information is included in that summary.
Super. We will take questions at the end, and we'll just have everybody come up together.
Madam Chair and members, our next speaker is Glenn Scuta. He's the Water Monitoring Manager at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and he's going to discuss the MPCA Ambient Groundwater Network and contaminants of emerging concern.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Glenn Scuta, Water Monitoring Manager, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm here to talk to you about our Ambient Groundwater Monitoring Network. You just heard the Department of Agriculture talk about their network in the agricultural parts of the state, monitoring things like nitrates and pesticides. Our network is focused in the non-agricultural parts of the state. This map shows where our wells are currently located in the network, as well as the wells that will be going in this year and next year. We've got over 200 wells in residential and undeveloped areas already brought into the network, and we'll have about 80 more going in this year and next year to bring the network to full size. Specifically today, I want to talk to you about monitoring that we've done and a report that we put out on contaminants of emerging concern. And this is an umbrella term used for a variety of chemicals. things like fragrances and hand cleaners, pharmaceuticals, hormones, fire retardants, a large variety of chemicals that humans use and we put into the environment either through wastewater or just through the air, depositing these types of chemicals onto the land, eventually into the ground. Doing this type of monitoring is highly specialized, as Dan Stoddard talked about earlier. We're talking about measuring chemicals in parts per billion, parts per trillion. Specialized monitoring equipment is shown in the graphic. It is needed to do this type of monitoring so that we're not getting false positives or false negatives. Special aluminum filter plate equipment, special lines that have to be rinsed and triple rinsed to ensure that a sampling event doesn't contaminate a future sampling event. So this is highly specialized, complicated monitoring. We put out a report that is available 1 year ago on what we have found thus far as we just began to monitor for these chemicals. Slide indicated earlier that umbrella term of CECs, contaminants of emerging concern. It's really talking about chemicals that have not typically been monitored in the past. This is just the last few years that our agency and others have begun to monitor for these chemicals, began to realize that they may have impacts that have to be studied. So this report was after our first year of monitoring 40 wells of our network, and we'll be continuing to do that monitoring as time goes on. To give you the results, and then I'll give you some details on how we got there and more details on them, the basic findings of the study that we did a year ago show that we have a low frequency of detection of CECs in groundwater, and when we do find them, we find them at very, very low levels of detection. And we did this study targeting wells that would be more likely to be contaminated, kind of a worst-case scenario to see if there was any real immediate big problems to start addressing. And even though we targeted more wells more likely to be contaminated, we still found infrequent detection and at very low levels. So this does start to give us a baseline understanding of what current conditions are, and gives us a baseline to work forward for further monitoring into the future and eventually the development of trends. So the 40 wells that were sampled in the study are shown on this map. Again, we're sampling in developed areas, residential areas, and undeveloped areas. More than half the wells were in residential areas, both those that are served by city sewer as well as areas served by septic systems. The way we targeted the wells, we looked for wells that had data showing the presence of nitrates and boron, which are chemicals found in wastewater, so not a determiner per se, but an indicator that these wells were receiving some amount of contamination from wastewater, which is, again, a major potential conduit for CECs. We also just did three wells that were basically in the plumes of old, closed, unlined landfills to see what type of chemicals, what type of CECs might be coming out of landfills as well. These are monitoring wells, not drinking water wells, and related to these landfills. The monitoring that we did, the laboratory that did the analysis of the samples, scans for about 100 different emerging contaminants, again, antibiotics and hormones, detergents and their metabolites, personal care products, fire retardants, etc. About 30 of the 100 that were scanned are what are known as EACs, or endocrine active compounds, compounds that are shown to have some amount of impact on the hormones or endocrine systems of humans and animals. Again, what we found there in terms of CEC detections in groundwater, about a third of the wells, 13 of the 40, we found at least some CECs in. In most cases, we found four or less, and most frequently we found no detections, where we did find detections, most commonly it was one detection. Two of the landfill wells where we had the most detections of 10 and 8 chemicals that were found in their leachate plumes. on that map, the pink circles are where we had no detections, and the red are where we did have some detections. In terms of frequency, in terms of which chemicals did we see most often, the most common chemical was found in 7 wells, and it's a chlorinated phosphate that is a fire retardant. Likely pathway for that chemical is that it's a chemical that's used to treat clothing to make it fire resistant. And again, when the clothing is laundered, it goes into the wastewater and then can find its way into the groundwater. The second most common CEC that was found was the sulfa antibiotic, and then after that was a couple of plastics or plasticizer chemicals. In terms of the EACs, the 30 endocrine active compounds that were scanned, we found just 3 of those 30 that were located or were detected in the samples. Again, the plasticizer BPA was found in 3 wells, an estrogen in 1 well, and a detergent breakdown product in 1 well as well. But these were all found at very, very low levels. The BPA was found at the highest level of these 3, and it was at its highest level about 4.5 parts per billion. And the health risk limit for reference on that chemical is 300 parts per billion. So well below the risk level. So that was the finding overall, that no concentrations of chemicals that were found exceeded any applicable health guidance values, though one of the big unknowns with EACs right now is we don't know what the health risk values are for all of these chemicals. At the time of this study, only 15% of the chemicals that were analyzed have an established level. And Jim Kelly will be speaking shortly about CECs and health risk values and such. Again, kind of the worst of the worst case scenario, the landfill wells really showed the greatest number of chemicals detected, the highest concentrations, but even these were still well below health guidance values. By comparison, you can see that the highest concentration in the landfill wells is as high as 14 parts per billion. In the non-landfill wells, under 3 parts per billion. 10 detected in landfill wells, only 4 chemicals detected in non-landfill wells. So, again, in summary, a very low frequency of detection and very low levels of detection of CECs at this point, even though we were targeting wells most likely to be contaminated. Emerging contaminants present in about a third of the wells, endocrine active compounds in 3 of the 40 wells, and the landfill wells being the highest level and frequency of detection. But we will continue to do further monitoring to refine this assessment. Again, it was just 40 wells of a much larger network to start to give us that baseline understanding. And it's important, as has been said in previous presentations, that monitoring is about getting data and information gathered over time. Once we do this over the course of years, we'll be able to see trends. Are things actually getting better, or are they getting worse? And as time goes on, too, methods get better. They're more sensitive. We can detect these chemicals at lower levels, and we can detect more chemicals. Scanning right now for 100 chemicals, and current methods are going to be allowing us to scan for 150 to 200 chemicals as of this year. We do have some additional reports coming soon. They're not complete, and findings are not detailed at this time, but this summer we will give an update to this CEC report, which will have data from 120 wells, so 3 times the number of wells as in this study, to give an update of what we are finding in a broader part of our ambient network. And then this spring, for the next couple months here, we will have a report out on the overall groundwater network. Just to give you a little sneak preview on that, one of the findings there that we're seeing is elevated chloride levels in the state, primarily in the metro area. The red dots are where we have the highest levels of chloride contamination in sand and gravel aquifers. And most likely the use of road salt is causing these levels to elevate. And some of these wells, many of these wells we do have trend data on, because we're utilizing wells that have been around for a long time as much as possible. And chloride trends in some areas are showing that they are increasing. So that full report, again, will be coming out in a couple of months. So with that, I will end, and we'll hear more on contaminants, the emerging concern from Jim Kelly.
Madam Chair and members, our next speaker is Jim Kelly. He is the manager of the Environmental Surveillance and Assessment Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health, and he's going to be discussing emerging issues in groundwater risk assessment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Dan said, I'm Jim Kelly. I manage the Environmental Surveillance and Assessment section at the Minnesota Department of Health, and it's our area that's engaged in the areas around risk assessment for groundwater contaminants. First of all, I wanted to just say briefly, what is the concern? We've heard a lot already about contaminants of emerging concern and other contaminants in groundwater. Obviously, this is the reason that we're doing this work, is we do have a fair amount of chemicals that are out there. Some 80,000 chemicals or more are already used in commerce on an annual basis, and more are being added all the time. So there's certainly a large number of chemicals out there that we're starting to find out more about in terms of being environmental contaminants. We're starting to get better at looking for these chemicals in the environment. We've already heard a lot about monitoring for contaminants in groundwater, but also in other areas as well. There was a story in both Twin Cities paper this morning about a University of Minnesota study that looked at levels of triclosan, which is essentially an antibiotic that's used in hand soaps and other personal care products, and it being found in lake sediments around the state at increasing levels. That's just an example of a lot of the work that's going on that we're also involved in terms of trying to understand the potential for human impacts from some of these contaminants. That's just one example. So we're looking for these contaminants in more and more places, including people, through biomonitoring studies and other avenues that we're starting to find out more about these contaminants. We have better laboratory analytical methods now than we ever have before, and a number of speakers have already touched on that. These contaminants can be very difficult to monitor for not only standard methods to do so, but more and more methods are becoming available as this is a growing topic of interest. And we're certainly interested in developing and looking at new ways to find these chemicals. Secondly, there's new ways of measuring toxicity of chemicals. We're finding out more and more about both existing and some of these newer chemicals' potential to be toxic to both humans and other organisms in the environment. Through new ways of testing toxicity that weren't available even just a few years ago. We're looking at more subtle effects. Our previous speaker, Glenn, mentioned things like endocrine disruptors. So these can be very subtle impacts on organisms in terms of their ability to regulate their hormone systems and what are the implications of that. We're starting to get a better handle on those types of sensitive testing that's going on. Things like immune system effects that can be very subtle and very difficult to measure. We're starting to learn more about and see more studies published about these potential types of effects that we need to take into account when we evaluate these chemicals. And lastly, we have some catching up to do. We have toxicity data on only a limited number of the chemicals and even fewer health-based guidance values that we've been able to develop. So there's certainly, while there's a lot of chemicals out there in the environment, we're not quite there yet in terms of understanding the potential for them to impact human health and the environment. So we've got some catching up to do. In terms of health risk assessment activities at the Department of Health that are fall within my section, we have two separate programs that we use to develop guidance values for groundwater and drinking water. One is our health risk limits program, which is kind of our traditional program that we've had in place for some period of time, looking at contaminants that have already been detected in groundwater. So these are existing groundwater contaminants. Oftentimes, industrial solvents is one example. Gasoline contaminants, for instance, would fall into that category. It includes naturally occurring substances, things like elements that are found naturally in the environment that we still need to pay attention to in terms of their potential for toxicity. It's a rule-based program where that rule is updated and revised every couple of years. And through a very public rulemaking process. And these values are requested and generally used by our environmental agency partners in cleanup and other regulatory decisions. So we work very much hand in hand when it comes to developing what priorities we're going to be exploring through that particular program. We also have what we call the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program, which, as Glenn said, is kind of an umbrella term for contaminants that were either more recently found or more recently become a concern. And this program, which is funded through the Clean Water Legacy Funds, allows us to look at substances that have been released to or detected in Minnesota waters, which can be surface water or groundwater. So it's an opportunity to look at chemicals that maybe haven't yet been detected in groundwater or drinking water sources, but have the potential to migrate to Minnesota waters. We do this through a nomination process where these chemicals are nominated for evaluation through this program, which is a public process. So we get input from the public, from our partner environmental agencies, and other researchers who might be working in this particular area. Helps us set priorities in terms of what contaminants we're going to be looking at. It's used to guide research. Some of the activities I mentioned, both at our partner agencies and institutions such as the University of Minnesota, to help direct where some of their activities may need to be focused. It can also be used as a tool to educate the public about things like triclosan and the importance of paying attention to these types of contaminants and their presence in consumer products, and more importantly, what happens to those consumer products. This is just a list, and again, it's kind of hard to see, obviously, on the screen. But of the chemicals that have been nominated to the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program, and they include a number of the contaminants that, again, Glenn Skuta mentioned and others have mentioned as being looked for, monitored for in the environment. So we've been nominated to our program, and some of the ones in italics and in bold are ones that we've actually developed guidance for. Things like bisphenol A, which is, again, Glenn mentioned, has been detected at low levels in groundwater. Triclosan, which as I mentioned obviously previously, we've developed a guidance value for. So it allows us to gauge when these contaminants are detected in the environment, what levels are a potential impact to human health, and so that we can take steps to understand and if necessarily take action with regards to these particular chemicals. This just shows it a little bit different way. These are the categories of chemicals that have been nominated, and they include things like pesticides, metals, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, flame retardants, so again, detergents, surfactants. A lot of the contaminants that we've talked about a little bit already today are the types of things that have been nominated to be evaluated through the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program and the things that we're focusing on moving forward. I wanted to highlight just one contaminant that we regionally developed guidance for, and that's microcystin. Microcystin is a concern in ambient and recreational water quality. It's been generally been a concern for swimming, boating, fishing, livestock, and pests. Just briefly, microcystin is a contaminant or a toxin produced by blooms of cyanobacteria, more commonly referred to as blue-green algae, but they're in fact bacteria. So these are the things that it's a toxin that's produced when these cyanobacteria bloom or have excessive growth in surface water bodies. It is mainly today been a concern for things like livestock or pets. You hear occasionally of dogs who drink water who suffer health problems or even die as a result of drinking that water. More recently, we've had concerns have been expressed, and this is why the contaminant was nominated for evaluation by our program, as a potential surface water contaminant for surface waters that are used for drinking water sources. There's also a concern that we may be seeing more and more of this type of contamination as our summers get hotter and drier. We seem to be seeing more and more blooms of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria that could be producing microcystin. Another concern is groundwater that's under the influence of surface water. And I have an example I'll get to just in a second. But obviously, groundwater and surface water, as we heard in our previous hearing, is interconnected. And wells that are near surface water bodies can be heavily influenced by surface water quality. We haven't detected microcystin in Minnesota groundwater, but we've just started looking for it, and we suspect that in the future we might detect it. And as I mentioned, we developed guidance values this past year that can help guide these research efforts. This is just one example. This is Little Rock Lake, located in Benton County, where the MPCA and the Department of Health coordinated an investigation in 2011 following a bloom of cyanobacteria. Again, it's very hard to see on the screen, but you can actually see in the northern part of the lake, a very large bloom of what looks like algae, but it's in fact cyanobacteria. We detected high levels of microcystin in the surface water, and the concern was for the private wells that are located immediately adjacent to the lake and whether they've been influenced or could be drawing in surface water contaminated with microcystin. At this point, in this particular situation, we didn't detect anything necessarily in private wells, but the timing of that investigation may have been partly responsible for that. So this is a concern that we're going to be continuing to follow, continuing to work with our sister agencies with regards to this particular contaminant. Recent challenges that we've been wrestling with through this process of establishing groundwater risk assessment is looking at state versus federal standards and guidance. Oftentimes, federal guidance is developed for using different methodologies and different purposes. So we get in a situation where we're trying to explain the differences between state and federal guidance, and that can present some challenges. Naturally occurring substances we've been learning more and more about, and what we termed as new findings for old contaminants, research doesn't stop. We're finding out new things about contaminants that have previously been looked at that we didn't necessarily know, so we have to evaluate that with regards to the drinking water guidance. Human versus ecological health, we need to take care not to confuse the two issues. Things that may or may not be a concern for human health can still be a concern for ecotoxicity for things in the environment, our fish and wildlife, and other things in the environment. So we need to make sure that we're not confusing the two when we're talking about these particular issues. Laboratory analytical capacity today has been limited for some of these chemicals. A lot of the work that we've talked about today, at least for some of the more exotic contaminants, is done out of state because we don't have the capacity within the state to do the work. So we're working with our public health laboratory and our colleagues at the Agriculture Department laboratory to try to increase the ability to detect these contaminants here in the state. And then staffing. I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention that finding and locating and obtaining the staff that it takes to do very technical, very difficult evaluations can be challenging. And we'll just recently be fully staffed with this particular program. In terms of the research activities that we're very closely following and taking part in, we're trying to develop and looking to develop alternative risk characterization and assessment methods to allow us to speed up the process of developing new criteria for groundwater. With some 80,000 chemicals that I mentioned in commerce, we need to develop faster ways to evaluate them, at least on a screening level, so that we can identify which contaminants we might need to focus more strongly on. We have to look at relative source contribution. When some of these contaminants that we're talking about are also in personal care products, or things that we use on our bodies or in within our bodies, we need to pay attention to those other exposures in addition to water, and that takes research and knowing what those exposures entail. As I mentioned, analytical capabilities and increasing that is important. And then we have a number of other special projects that we're pursuing through various activities within our programs. We're also engaging the public and trying to educate them about these chemicals because they're the users of generally these products, and demand, as we know, is one of the reasons that these chemicals were used in some of these products to begin with. So we try to highlight our work and let people know what we find in terms of the potential health impacts. We have an advisory forum and task force groups that meet with us on a regular basis to help guide and shape our work. We're also engaged in some outreach and education activities that help identify and shed light on these particular contaminants, and even go to the point of promoting and supporting pharmaceutical and hazardous materials collection activities to try to get these chemicals out of the environment or prevent them from getting in the environment in the first place, which I think is critical when it comes to managing some of these particular contaminants. For more information, there's my contact information. You also do have a one-page sheet that summarizes some of the points that I've covered along with my contact information. And with that, I think that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, our final presenters are going to be Randy Ellingbo, who is the manager of the Drinking Water Protection Services section, and Chris Elgram, who is the manager of the Well Management section at the Minnesota Department of Health, who are going to speak on drinking water protection.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak today. My name is Randy Ellingbo. I'm with the Section of Drinking Water Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health. And with me is my colleague, Chris Albrum, who is with our Well Management section. And I'll be talking first about drinking water protection in context with public water supplies, and appreciate the opportunity to follow my colleagues here whose work and presentations have set a great stage for some of the things that we'll be talking about in relation to public water supply protection. And I also want to acknowledge the work of the public water supply operators across the state who protect the public through their efforts. I want to talk very briefly, although the presentation is primarily about groundwater, I want to note that roughly 25% of Minnesotans who use public water supplies use surface waters as the source. And the map that you'll see shows communities across Minnesota, including the metro area, who get their public water supply sources from surface waters. And the thing to note, as you just heard, is that surface waters do have considerable variability in water quality, and that can be a challenge from a treatment standpoint. It typically requires more treatment of surface waters to meet federal standards for drinking water than groundwater supplies in many cases, although we'll talk in a minute about groundwater under the influence of surface water. And again, I'll be talking primarily about finished water in this context. We've heard primarily about naturally occurring ground and surface water to this point. I'll be talking mostly in context with finished water. I want to note that across Minnesota, we have over 11,000 public water supply wells serving over 950 public water supply systems that provide water to people in their homes. We call these community public water supply systems. They're typically the municipal systems that distribute water throughout the community. We also have over 7,000 non-community public water supplies that provide water to people where they work or play, typically for rural schools, restaurants, resorts, and so on. And these public water supply systems that use groundwater as their source serve somewhat over half the population of the state. We've also heard already a bit about groundwater quantity issues, and the map that you see here represents the locations of the community public water supply scattered across the state. And in the northwest and southwest portions of the map, there's some gray shading that represents the systems or the population served by rural water supplies. And particularly in northwest and southwest Minnesota, quantity and quality can both be limited or challenging for public water supplies, and so these rural water supply systems have been set up there to distribute water to the population. We also have other portions of the state, as you've already heard, where quantity is limited, and so water supply planning is really critical in these areas of high demand, low supply, or both. As we've also heard, while we do have good planning processes, our decisions are sometimes based on somewhat limited information in regard to the quality and quantity. Switching to the issue of groundwater quality, again, you've heard quite a bit about contaminants that are both naturally occurring and anthropogenic, and these present challenges to the drinking water treatment systems that serve us across the state. And these systems have to deal with microbiological, chemical, and radiological contaminants. We do have the good fortune that in some parts of Minnesota, the groundwater quality is such that no treatment is required for those systems. That's roughly 40%. That's very important since, as was already discussed, the cost for treatment can be substantial and is of concern to those communities. That does mean, though, that roughly 60% of our groundwater systems require treatment, either to remove those regulated contaminants, regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, or in communities that have chosen to, in addition, treat for contaminants that are not regulated but which are present in their groundwater, things like perfluorochemicals and so on. Good news in Minnesota is our public water supply operators do a great job. Our ongoing compliance levels with the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements set by EPA is greater than 99%, but that's because of ongoing diligence of the systems. And now, in regard to treatment of source water, again, touching briefly on surface waters change regularly or continually, actually, and that for those systems that use surface waters for their drinking water, it can be a challenge to maintain effective treatment. And as you've already heard, groundwater may vary in vulnerability. Some of our groundwater is under the direct influence of surface water. Some may show impacts from our activities at the surface over time. Some is well protected and in deep layers. But that is important in regard to the treatment systems in terms of knowing what the source waters are and what they may have to deal with for issues in their treatment systems. And I do want to note, this is extremely critical. Prevention is a cost-effective way for groundwater to be managed so that we limit our potential costs associated with treatment. If we can do prevention, we can save costs. A number of communities across the state have had to install treatment systems in the recent past. Again, St. Peter, Hastings, other communities have had to install treatment in order to address some groundwater issues in their area. St. Peter's plant cost almost $19 million. They have a sophisticated reverse osmosis plant that deals with nitrate, but also with other chemicals of emerging concern. One of the ways that's really critical in order to protect public health is, of course, to know what the quality of the water is that's being delivered to the public, and that's where testing comes in. And public water supplies are required to test their waters regularly. The Safe Drinking Water Act covers over 100 contaminants, and so public water supplies must address those contaminants if they are present. The frequency and number of parameters that are tested for in finished water varies depending on the risk that those contaminants may be present. The water source quality varies considerably across the state, as we've already heard. Again, in vulnerable aquifers, they may have larger issues to deal with in terms of potential contaminants that they may encounter. Deep wells protected by impermeable layers in Minnesota typically have much more stable water, and so may or may not require treatment, and that depends on the testing that we do to find what contaminants may be present. As we consider also what contaminants may have to be removed for the finished water, we consider the duration of exposure to the public and whether they're acute or chronic contaminants. You've heard a bit about testing challenges that we're facing. That's also true for the finished water. We have this increasing ability to detect more contaminants at lower concentrations, and of course a lack of standards for unregulated contaminants. That does pose a challenge for us on an ongoing basis in terms of assessing these impacts for public health. And the public, as you know, has a need and a right to know the quality of their drinking water, and community public water supplies annually publish a consumer confidence report that reports on the quality of their water during the year. We also have some other issues that we find in terms of our work as we monitor these systems. We've discovered that water chemistry can change in the distribution system, and so we are studying the potential impacts of that. You've heard recently in the news about treatment failures, or pardon me, you've heard recently about breaks in water mains. Whether it's a treatment failure or a break in a water main, we may see a public health risk from that. When we have a break, there's a potential for contaminants to enter the distribution system, and so those lines have to be taken offline. The public has to be advised of what they need to do, whether or not use it or boil it or whatever, and that is the responsibility of our public water supplies to inform the public when those things happen. Unfortunately, we do have an aging infrastructure in some parts of Minnesota. Back in 2007, the Environmental Protection Agency did a needs assessment for Minnesota, and they estimated that over the next 20 years or so, roughly $6 billion in investment may be needed for replacing infrastructure, whether that's treatment systems, pipes, or other aspects of the infrastructure. And some communities are set up better than others to be able to pay those costs. Some set rate structures that allow them to invest in the infrastructure in an ongoing basis and stay up on maintenance. For other communities, as we know across the state, there are economic challenges, and that may make it more challenging for them to be able to keep up on investing in their infrastructure. We do have a great public finance authority agency in this state that can provide revolving loans for financing this infrastructure, but the communities need to be able to do those investments in order to take advantage of that system. What I'd like to end my presentation with is a brief discussion of source water protection. The map that you'll see in, on this slide is an aerial photo of a community, and the green lines that you'll see on this map define the drinking water source management area. And for community public water supplies and non-community public water supplies, our staff will work with the communities to do a hydrogeologic assessment to determine the area where their source water for their groundwater systems may be affected by activities at the surface. And within this green area, that's the zone of most important to try and prevent groundwater contamination. Preparation of these plans for community public water supplies is required by Minnesota rule, and roughly 440 of our over 950 community public water supplies have either begun work or completed their plans for now. These have to be revised every 10 years or when there is a new well that goes online or some change to the system. And it's, of course, really critical to note that prevention is more cost-effective and efficient than cleanup, treatment, or drilling a new well. And so these source water protection efforts are really critical for our community public water supplies as well as our groundwater water supplies across the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Chris Alvrum, Well Management Section Manager, Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to continue to talk about drinking water, but I'm going to focus on the 20% of Minnesotans who use private individual wells for their primary source of drinking water. And the main point I want to make is that in contrast to the public water supplies, which you've heard a lot about from Randy, there's little regulation or oversight regarding private individual wells. We have about 250,000 private wells in the state that are used for drinking water, and you can see from this trend that as the economic downturn hit the state and the country, the number of wells that went in for private wells declined from about 12,000 a year to under 5,000, and it mirrors the residential building permits. You can see a little uptick last year, and hopefully we'll see the same in the residential building permits. You saw this map in the previous hearing on Thursday, last Thursday, and this is actually all wells in the state. We find about 85% of new wells are private domestic wells, so the vast majority of these are the private individual wells. But the rest are things like industrial wells, monitoring wells, those community water supply wells, irrigation wells. Some of the risks to those who use private individual wells for their drinking water source include the contaminants we've heard a lot about today, naturally occurring and anthropogenic. Floods are a particular risk. They can often bring contaminants with them, compromise a well, and contaminate wells. Unsealed wells, sometimes referred to as abandoned wells, are a risk not just to private well owners, but to all groundwater users. They provide a conduit directly down to our aquifer systems that can allow contaminants to easily reach what might be otherwise protected by the natural geology. We talked about quantity at the last hearing and a little bit today, and we've heard about some wells that have gone dry up on the North Shore this year because of the drought. This happens also in other areas of the state when it's not just the lack of rainfall, but the increased pumping, and some higher capacity wells have influenced or interfered with private wells. And those wells, it may not that they be dry, but they'll be out of water when the water level gets drawn down below the pump, and they'll have to address that issue. And then, of course, wells that are not properly maintained can be a physical hazard. We probably all recall back in the 80s when baby Jessica fell down the well in Texas. We have been addressing sealing of wells. This is a graph showing from about 1992 to the present. This is cumulative, so we have actually exceeded the 250,000 well mark in 2011 for wells sealed. But we do estimate another 250,000 to 500,000 unsealed, unused wells in the state. So as I mentioned, these private wells have relatively little regulation and oversight. There's a well code that we heard a little bit about earlier that governs how the well is constructed, where it can be placed. It needs to be set back certain distances from contaminant sources. It needs to have a minimum depth. It has to have materials that are protective and grouting so that stuff can't leak down next to a well. And we see that reflected in the nitrate concentration. Less than 1% exceed the drinking water standard. This is new wells, new private wells. And We attribute that to the well code. If you take all wells in the state, including all those wells that were constructed prior to 1975, it's more like 6% exceed the drinking water standard. Bacteria wells have to test negative for bacteria before they can put into use, and only since 2008 have wells been required to test for arsenic, and we see about 10% exceed that drinking water standard. And again, those drinking water standards are just for your reference. They don't apply to private wells. There's no additional testing or treatment required, so if your well exceeds the standard for any nitrate or arsenic, we send information to the well owner, but the follow-up action is really the responsibility of that well owner. So just to focus on arsenic briefly, it's not evenly distributed in the state. Those darker counties, it's between 31% and 45% of new wells exceeding the drinking water standard. It's a naturally occurring element. It's difficult to predict. We'll find two wells that have very similar construction and geology and very different arsenic concentrations. It's complex geochemical factors that really determine the arsenic concentration. And again, the well code does a good job at protecting things from getting into wells from the land surface, but arsenic is at depth, and so it's not protected. It doesn't do anything to address arsenic. Again, one more map on arsenic. We do know something about its occurrence. It's correlated to what's known as the Des Moines Lobe glacial till. It's a clay glacial deposit shown in gray on this map, and so you can see those red dots are all the wells that exceed the arsenic standard. And they are mostly in the area where this Des Moines Lobe till is located. But you can see it doesn't mean that you will find arsenic or you won't if you're not in the area. It's just an indicator of where there's likely to be more arsenic. So for private wells, the location and construction is regulated to protect human health and groundwater, again, primarily from those land use activities in the area. New wells are only sampled for those three constituents, and there's really no requirement for follow-up sampling, and there's no requirement that older wells before the well code that they be sampled at any given time. We do provide information to all new well owners and to those who have specific information for those who have an exceedance of nitrate or arsenic, but again, it's up to the well owner to take actions afterwards. So I just want to summarize, and I really wrote this as a summary for drinking water, but it has built into a lot of what you heard over the last two hearings. Groundwater is essential to economic growth and development. Nobody will argue that. We have relatively bountiful supplies, but there are issues, and those supplies are not limitless. Human activities impact the quantity and quality. We've heard a lot about both of those things over the last couple of days. There are contaminants that are both naturally occurring and anthropogenic. And those unregulated or contaminants of emerging concern present a particular challenge because of the lack of information we have about their occurrence and the health risks from those contaminants. Protection is key. This is true not only for public water supplies, as Randy pointed out. It's much more cost effective to protect the groundwater quality than it is to try to clean it up or to treat it in a public water supply system. Same is true for ecosystems. Once you damage an ecosystem, it's very difficult to repair, and it's much more effective to protect those ecosystems. Public infrastructure investments are necessary. As we've heard about the investments necessary over the next decades to ensure our water supplies are protected, and the information and education are critical. I just want to thank you on behalf of all the agencies that are presented here. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk about our groundwater issues and hope to work with you in the future to protect our supplies. Thank you.
Thank you. And if folks would just come up, if Paige's could help them get chairs all up for questions. And as they're coming up, Jim Kelly mentioned that there were two articles in the Strib and in the Pioneer Press this morning about triclosan. And we will get those articles for you and send them to you by email. I would just note that triclosan and what the recent studies have shown by the University of Minnesota, the triclosan, which is in our hand soaps and lots of other things, turns into dioxin, and it has been found as dioxin in the Mississippi River. So that's one of the things. The Lake Pepin area, I think, is where they were doing the test wells. So it's very much worth your while to read those articles And if the committee would like to hear from Dr. Bill Arnold, who is the lead scientist from the U on that, I would be glad to invite him to the committee. So with that, members, folks are ready for questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for either Mr. Stoddard or Mr. Montgomery talking about the nitrate studies. And I would just ask if in the last, 5 or 10 years, have there been any trends in terms of increased or decreased levels of nitrates in groundwater?
Madam Chair, may this Bruce Montgomery, I'll respond to your question. I'm not sure if I quite understand the question, but very, very difficult to establish any trends under a very short period of time. And did I understand your question right? Are you questioning the value of the trend under a short time frame?
Madam Chair, no, I guess my point is in the last, 5 or 10 years, fertilizer, especially nitrogen, has gotten so expensive. Mm-hmm. Farmers are putting on just what the university recommends, the split application, spoon feeding. Would that make a difference in terms of nitrate levels in the groundwater?
Madam Chair and committee, yes, it can have a very profound impact. And that's one of the reasons the university and Department of Ag and other cooperators are very careful and meticulous in developing best management practices and making sure that we have the research information to continue up with technology. That technology has changed dramatically over the years. Variable rate application, sensors, there's many, many tools out there that growers have access to, and many of them are quickly adapting to it. One of the challenges, though, that we're seeing, think about the last couple of years. We had some optimal growing conditions starting in the springs of the last couple of years, and then what happened? We ran out of water. And so we know that in many cases we just can't utilize everything. Water controls so much of what happens with plant physiology. And when we run out of water and we end up with nitrate levels still occurring in the soil, that's usually the off-season time. When we do get a wet period, that's the time we're going to probably have some appreciable N losses. So the goal in our nutrient management strategies is kind of a put-and-take technology. We're going to put out there exactly what the plant needs. Sometimes this is change variable rate over the landscape because of our soils and crop uptake are different. And then the goal, hopefully, is very minimal nitrates left in the soil profile by the time the fall comes. Now, again, when we have drought conditions like we've had the last couple of years, we've probably seen some pretty appreciable ones. You may be seeing news releases coming out this spring from the University of Minnesota, really encouraging growers to use the deep soil nitrate test. Typically, we don't use that in this state, but because of the dry conditions the last couple of years, we may see some need to do some adjustments because of those very facts. Thank you for your question.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up on nitrogen, probably aimed at the health department. We hear about blue baby syndrome as one of the health consequences of high nitrate levels. Is the incidence of that changed over time? Are there other health consequences that we should be aware of?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with regards to nitrate, certainly the primary driver historically for a nitrate standard has been the occurrence of methemoglobinemia, or blue baby syndrome as it's also known. I think in my sense is that remains a fairly rare event. It's almost typically noteworthy when it does occur. And part of the challenges with nitrate is also in looking at the potential for other health effects or health impacts that could be associated with that. At such a time that a nitrate standard is reviewed again, we would certainly be looking at other information to determine whether any other potential health impacts would potentially be a driver for a different standard. But traditionally, it has been based on prevention of that particular impact, which fortunately is relatively rare.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So is there any identifiable trend?
To be honest, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that information in front of me. That's just my sense at this point that it's a relatively rare occurrence. But we can certainly look at that information and try to get back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what other health impacts would you identify being connected to nitrates?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's something that also, I think there's a fairly broad array of different things that have been looked at from time to time. I don't have those off the top of my head. Again, we would have to come back to you with that particular information.
That would be helpful. Just a follow-up on that question. I don't remember who, said that St. Peter had to spend $16 million on their new system in order to get the nitrates out. Who paid for that? I mean, $16 million is pretty stiff for a small town.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Randy Ellingbo, it is a substantial investment. The community is who pays for that over time, and so it is typically allocated through their public water supply rate system. It's the money that they are paid for their water. And of course it's financed over time, but nevertheless that cost remains. So, and the system, I did want to mention, the system that they installed was reverse osmosis, which is a very sophisticated system that allows it to deal with not only nitrate but other contaminants like radium, and actually a quite wide array of contaminants. So it's very sophisticated, and they thought it a good investment for the future.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may not actually be a question that any of you want to answer, but my mind goes to conservation. You've talked about protecting and having good finished water, but what are we doing to encourage people to conserve their use of water so that we don't have so much being drawn off and then higher concentrations of problems?
Madam Chair, each water supplier in the state is required to have a water conservation and emergency plan, or those serving over 1,000 people, and that's required by the DNR, and that includes conservation measures, which could be a rate structure or education. And so it does vary from place to place. Some communities, kind of depends on their situation as far as lawns go and their housing stock, if it's older or newer. So there's requirement for conservation to appropriate water in the state, but there's no hard and fast rule, and the trend, it varies by community.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's really encouraging. The ag trends continue to improve. When you hear, and it was through like the testifiers are talking about, whether it's precision agriculture and best management practices. And when you go through here and listen to the testimony from the Department of Ag, and you see things that say no pesticide concentrations exceeded Department of Health drinking water risk levels, and a quote was several 100 times lower than the Department of Health standards. And specifically here for atrazine, since 2009, the detection, well, it was said that so low they can't even detect it. And again, that comes through the education process, and farmers have done a wonderful, wonderful job doing that. When you take a look at the 100 emerging contaminants and detection frequency, and you talk about the ones that are the most prevalent, it is the household, everyday household items. So my question would be, what are we doing as far as education and to addressing those concerns and those needs moving forward as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe there's a number of activities going on around the state to help encourage the proper collection of pharmaceuticals in particular would be one example where law enforcement, at least in the area I particularly live in, is coordinating a more organized collection of pharmaceuticals in order to prevent their getting into the environment. I think it's through studies and other activities in public education that some of the formulations of the products such that contain contaminants such as triclosan or things that we're identifying as contaminants are starting to change. Whereas you see other consumer products that are labeled EPA-free, for instance, I think it's an issue of growing consumer awareness of the potential for these chemicals that are used in products that have kind of unintended consequences that's starting to lead to the change in formulation. So I think it's a combination of education and steps that are being taken on the part of manufacturers of these products that's helping to encourage a better stewardship of these products so we don't end up with these chemicals getting into the environment. It's also a matter of education on folks who own individual septic systems and other things for them to be aware of what practices they need to follow in terms of preventing these chemicals from getting in the environment as well. That's the extent that I'm aware of in terms of the education and other efforts. I don't know if there's other activities that are more regulatory in nature. My colleague at MPCA is shaking his head, so that's something that I think there could be other avenues there as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we also talked about natural contaminants. Just out of curiosity, as far as contaminants, what percentage is natural and then what percentage would be, I guess, unnatural?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that I could, off the top of my head, come up with the percentage of those numbers. If you'd like, though, if we could provide you more information about the occurrence of contaminants as we see it in drinking water. There's also the environmental side. What I need to mention is for public water supplies, the primary testing is done at the finished water level, meaning what's being distributed to the public. We have less information about the raw water that these systems use. There is limited information in terms of these contaminants occurrence in the source water for groundwater systems. So generally, if treatment is required, it's installed to cover a wide array of materials. And as I say, we are not spending the money on testing on the raw water side, but rather on the finished water side. So.
We have three more questions, and then we are going to then ask folks to do written questions. So if the last three could be really quick. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Montgomery. You, on your handout that you had, you talked about the Park Rapids well number 4, and you showed on the graph the nitrate level being about 9 parts per million. What other wells? Does Park Rapids have other wells other than this is number 4? So I'm curious to know that, and I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, it's very typical in these superficial sands for communities like the size of Park Rapids to have multiple wells. And one of the challenges in trying to describe the problems is a lot of times if the well is contaminated or is approaching or exceeds the drinking water standard, the well gets shut down. I suspect that particular well has been shut down since, and one of the big challenges that these smaller communities have is then finding adequate water to either blend the water down or do some other type of a treatment system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then at some other spots in your presentation, you talked about, in particular, you said that roughly in one of the PowerPoint slides, you said roughly 20 to 25 public water suppliers in agriculture areas are dealing with nitrate issues. Can you define for me what dealing with nitrate issues is, and at what level do you start to deal with nitrate levels? How many parts per million?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm sure I'd be glad to answer that. About 20 to 25, we think, have some type of impacts. And keep in mind that there's an awful lot of stuff going on in the background. Between the blending, putting additional wells in, a lot of times this really kind of goes under the radar screen. And we projected those costs between 2 to 6 times cost for the impacts of nitrates. It's really difficult to kind of tease that information out because there's so many things going on in the background, including the drilling and so forth. One of the things I don't know if we talked about or not, but in some cases, obviously, the communities may be encouraged to drill deeper and try to get out of the superficial aquifer and get into some deeper systems. The problem with that, and the Department of Health can talk more about that if needed, but then we get into other contaminants. And it might be iron, might be radon, it might be other things, might be sulfides. There's always trade-offs here. And some communities decide that maybe they're going to put nitrate removal in because it might be the cheapest rather than trying to treat for iron or other things.
Specifically, trying to get back to your question, what defines, you know, when we're having problems. When we start to get above 5 parts per million or so, we know that there's something that we need to address. And a lot of this is prevention. We just have to do a much better job of using the limited resources we have to make sure we don't get in these type of predicaments where we have to go with treatment or do something else that's quite extreme. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, Representative, but yeah, there's a lot of different complicating factors going on here. And fortunately, we have some very good agencies and local support to help us deal with some of these.
I think the question you were getting into, Representative Fabian, is one of the ones that we need to spend more time on. I have two more questions and no more time. Is your question, Representative Clark, quick, or should we ask for a written response?
Only one of them is quick. I could ask the quick one.
Ask the quick one, but I do want us to do some written ones. I certainly have some. So
yeah, my longer ones have to do with some research, but I'll just ask about the quick one. I was concerned when I was hearing that there's no follow-up required for any of the private wells when there's a contamination. And I'm just wondering if the source of that is financial hardship in some cases, or just we never really looked at it. And the last thing I'll mention as a question that you can get back to me on, I guess, is does that mean that if you have people who are renters of those private wells, they have no right to know other than what the land owner may choose to tell them? That's my question for that.
Madam Chair and committee members, it's the only things that are required are for nitrate, arsenic, and bacteria at the time of well construction. And the homeowner can sample periodically. In fact, recommend that they sample, follow up sample every 1 to 3 years for bacteria and nitrate, depending on their well. But many homeowners, and if you buy a home with a private well, you may not even think about it ever again. So yes, it's not as a matter as there's any limit for the sampling. People can do it, but it really just relies on the homeowner's diligence to do that.
And the renter of a homeowner's well that's contaminated, do they have any right to know?
There's no law that requires that be disclosed to renters, as far as I know.
Thank you. That's going to end the questions because I am looking at the clock. I just want to mention two things to members. There is in your folder a summary of the Minnesota laws relating to water done by our counsel, Janelle Taylor. Very good. The second thing is, when we heard our first presentation, we heard about Southwest Minnesota running out of water, and we heard about the metro and how what we're doing is not sustainable. There are lots of other conflicts going on across the state with regard to water, so I have asked DNR to give us either a map or a list of those areas because they are broad. This is a much broader problem than Southwest and the metro. And with that, then, I would ask the water users in the state, since we obviously have problems which could be well exacerbated by this drought that we're in now, and we don't know that it's going to get worse or better, to bring solutions to us at our next hearing. We will have an opportunity for you to be heard. And with that, members, thank you. We'll see you next time.